I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Amid the wave of violence last week was a hopeful piece of news. The Kansas City, Missouri Council approved an ordinance that allows renters suffering from domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking to end a rental lease without penalty. It's a small step that could make a big difference. Today we'll discuss the new law and we'll hear how abuse victims can find alternative housing options. Then the president of the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank joins us. We'll quiz Esther George about interest rates, the health of the economy, and we'll ask her what threat the trade war with China poses to the heartland. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Starting on August 17, victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking in Kansas City can terminate a lease without penalties from a landlord under a new ordinance the City Council passed last week. Under the measure, sponsored by Councilwoman Jolie Justice, landlords are barred from evicting or otherwise retaliating against victims of such crimes. It passed unanimously. The new law's purpose was to make sure that victims of domestic violence and rape weren't trapped in their living arrangements because of leases, thereby further endangering them. And I should point out that this new law is not related to the inspection program proposal that's on Tuesday's ballot in Kansas City. With us is the councilwoman who spearheaded this drive to pass this ordinance. She just talked about violence in Kansas City. That's Jolie Justice. Jolie, it's always good to have you here.
Great to be back, Steve.
And also here is Christy Boffman. She's advocacy and education manager at the Rose Brooks Center. Christy, nice to have you too.
Good to be here.
Jolie, where did the idea for this ordinance come from? I mean, is this a Jolie Justice original, or did you adopt it from another city out there?
Actually, this was one of those cool things that was sort of a synergy between all of the jobs that I've had over the years. It started, as you know, Steve, I'm the director of pro bono legal services for my law firm, Shook, Hardy & Bacon, and over the last 20 years, I've met with a lot of survivors of domestic and sexual violence who have run into this problem. So it was just something that always bothered me as a lawyer when I'm trying to advocate on behalf of a client, that sometimes we would have clients that were in that unsafe space. And then moving forward, as we started to talk about violence in the community, I just mentioned that we really need to put together a toolbox of lots of local things to help combat this epidemic of violence in our community. And at the same time, we were having a conversation about housing in Kansas City, and some of the folks from MOXA came forward and suggested that this would be a good tool that we use here in the community. And then I also learned at the exact same time that State Senator-elect Lauren Arthur had penned a similar bill down in Jefferson City when she was in the State House and was looking to push that forward in Missouri. And so it really was just kind of everything coming together all at once.
Christy, how much of a difference is this new law going to wind up making here?
I mean, I think it's a big deal for a couple of reasons. I think that for me, one of the things that's most important is that it is an acknowledgement that domestic violence and sexual assault are really a community issue, and that we're addressing it as a community. I think that it goes a certain distance in terms of eliminating barriers that many of the clients that we work with face in terms of escaping a dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. Are we talking hundreds of people here who might be affected by this law? Is it fewer than that, Christy? Any sense?
I don't think I can give you a direct number in terms of how many people it will impact. What I can tell you is that the number one reason people cite for not leaving an abusive relationship is money. They can't afford to go anywhere. And if you think about how much it costs just to move into a new apartment, you know, first last month's rent, even the moving expenses, if you add to that the penalties that would be applied by breaking a lease, it just becomes insurmountable financially.
That's interesting. So abused people then can feel trapped in an apartment. Is that, am I capturing the feeling there?
Absolutely.
They're sitting ducks in a sense.
Yeah,
right?
And it can be a real barrier for people even wanting to come to shelter. Like if shelter seems like the safest place for them to come, if they can't get out of their lease, they might not come.
Wow. The danger then is what, Jolie? These survivors, as I mentioned this phrase, sitting ducks, the people who are abusing them know where they are, and then the survivors can't hide in a sense, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because the type of people who will be able to utilize this, if they do, will be pretty diverse. I have had clients who have come to me and they have been survivors of sexual assault. They've been raped in their own apartment. They do not know who their perpetrator is, and yet they are required to stay, number one, in the location where the rape took place, and then number two, not knowing who the rapist is. And so that was one of the very first pro bono cases that came into my world. And unfortunately, the young woman who came to me in this instance was not able to break her lease, and the best the landlord would do was change the locks, which was good. But she did not want to live at the place of the crime, and then she didn't want to live in a place where she didn't know who her perpetrator was. On the other hand, I have a client right now at our law firm who is the victim of domestic violence, and the children's division is waiting to reunify her with her children until she gets a safe and habitable location to live. And the place where she lives right now is not safe, one, because her perpetrator is out there, but two, because he came in and did significant damage to the apartment, and it's not a safe place for kids right now, and she can't break the lease. So it really starts to snowball for a lot of our victims, because one problem usually leads to about 30 or 40 other problems.
And Christy, I imagine you really can't undersell this notion, the level of fear that might be involved in some of these cases.
No, absolutely not. And I think we tend to really maybe downplay the dangerousness that survivors present, or that batterers present for survivors and for our community. One of the things I think about this ordinance is so important is that it really acknowledges and validates what's happening in terms of the danger that victims are facing, and it takes away some of the blame. But it's also not great for landlords to have a dangerous situation like that on their property as well.
Mm-hmm. They don't want that to be happening either.
No.
Yeah. I imagine that one trick here is going to be educating the community and letting people know that this option is now available to them out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important. And I think it's really important for us, too, as a service agency, to be able to figure out how we're going to help people be aware of that and how we're going to help people apply it.
Jolie.
And as part of that education piece, I also want to make it clear that it's starting August 17th, leases that are signed moving forward. I don't want anyone to think that if they are currently in a lease that they're going to be able to get relief under this. One of the things that our legal department made very clear was we could not do anything retroactive, that would be a constitutional violation.
That's always the case with so many of these laws. Retroactivity is oftentimes a challenge.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to the nuts and bolts of the law here, Jolie. Explain to us what happens now and how this ordinance will benefit women. How's it going to work going forward?
Sure thing. So moving forward, as I said, any lease that is signed on August 17th or later will be subject to this. And essentially what happens is if you have a survivor or a victim of domestic violence, sexual violence, or stalking, they will be able to give written notice to their landlord along with some documentation to show that they have had this incident. And the written documentation can include an ex parte, which is the precursor to a protective order. It can include a full order of protection granted by a court, or it can also include a medical provider giving written documentation that the incident has occurred. Hmm. It was important that we had that component because so many times with sexual violence in particular, the victim does not know who their perpetrator is. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to make sure that you didn't have a barrier to this just because you did not know who your perpetrator was.
Christy, is that level of proof reasonable? Is that going to be something that will hold women back from dealing with these situations or not really?
I mean, I think that there's plenty of support available for folks who want to obtain this kind of documentation. We have a hospital advocacy program, and that's certainly a place where we could be offering support to folks. And we also work in the order protection court as well. So I think when it comes to the order protection or the ex parte, it depends on whether that's something that's granted or not.
Okay. Will these victims get their security deposits back here, Christy?
I can address that, Steve.
Yeah.
The answer is they cannot be prevented from getting their security deposit because of this. Now, if there are other reasons that the security deposit would be withheld, then that can still be withheld. But you can't keep the security deposit from the victim just because they are taking this option. And the other thing that you need to know, Steve, is that essentially what this does is in Kansas City, it creates a crime for a landlord to refuse to terminate.
Oh, wow.
So that's how this works. So if
there's some real teeth in this law, then.
Right. And so what happens is working with an advocate, presumably, if a landlord refused to break the lease, the advocate or the victim could call the landlord and say, there is a city ordinance that says, if you don't let me do this, you could be facing a crime, at which point the victim would have to go to the police department and make a report that they had violated this law.
Again, how are you going to alert the landlords of Kansas City that, in fact, this law is going to be on the books beginning August 17th?
Well, I think part of it is probably already out there. We had one of the gentleman from the Landlords Association who was at the last hearing. He stood up and said that they didn't really have any concerns about the specific ordinance because, frankly, most good operators are already respecting these things. And I agree with that. But for those of us that have worked in the community and worked with victims, it's those handful of landlords who are not already doing the right thing that we're really going after.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking today about a new ordinance going in effect in Kansas City, Missouri in mid-August that will enable victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking to be able to terminate a lease without penalties from a landlord. The city council passed this just last week. You know, Christy, we're talking about this law fairly generically. Jolie mentioned a couple of specific examples, but can you think of specific people you've met who might benefit from this new law? And what can you tell us about them? Maybe describe their circumstances.
Absolutely.
To us.
I mean, during the the city council meetings where we were going over the ordinance, we actually had a survivor come and explain what her situation was. And it was exactly what I described earlier. She couldn't afford to move into a new apartment and face the penalties for breaking her lease. Like, just financially, it wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we experience a lot in terms of the clients that we provide support for.
And what kind of threat was she under, Christy?
I think it's just a threat that's compact. So one, her abuser knows where she's living, and that's, you know, that's always going to be a dangerous situation.
Yes.
And then there's just also feeling like you have the power and the self-determination to be able to move to a place that's safe.
Yeah. Well, if our listeners have questions about this new law, 816-235-2888 is the number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Councilwoman Justice, I can't help but wonder, what reaction did landlords have to this new law?
You know, it was mixed. We received a couple of phone calls at the office of landlords who were very concerned that individuals might use this to abuse the system. And I know that landlords from time to time have problem tenants. Without question, that is part of the business of being a landlord, and I understand that. But the city of Kansas City has said that we as a city, we believe that our policy is such that we start by believing when it comes to victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
And if an individual is going to go through the process of working with an advocacy group, of going to seek justice from a police department or from a court, we're going to stand by those survivors and make sure that they understand that this is one tool that might help them. Like I said, there was also some representation by the landlords at our two hearings. At the first hearing, there were two individuals who were speaking on their own behalf who asked for a language change, which we accommodated because we did not feel that it impacted the bill in a negative way. And then the second time we heard from an association who said that they did not have any problems with it because they felt that that's what landlords were already doing.
I'm struck by Christy's comment earlier that landlords, they don't want problem tenants either who might be facing violence down the road. That's a situation they don't want to be involved in either.
Absolutely. I've seen that in some instances where I've worked with victims advocates and landlords to come up with creative solutions to, and there's been no problem at all because they've come up with a creative solution because they don't want that sort of violence on their premises.
Yeah, I was really struck by the fact, Councilwoman, that the city council not only adopted this law, but they adopted it unanimously. Were you surprised by that?
I was a little surprised by that because there was some concern as we were crafting it that we made sure that we did something that was legal, that would not be preempted by the state of Missouri, and that would not have an adverse impact on any significant portion of the community. But I think after we had testimony from the advocacy groups and then also some of the survivors, it was pretty clear that folks realized that while there may be problems here and there, we can work through those, and that on balance, this was a positive.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, welcome to the show.
Now, thank you. Another great show. We've got rental property, and we keep it safe, sure. And there's just a lot of situations in ours that make it better than a lot of them. I'm just curious, though, as a landlord, I would think that if someone was harmed on my property, whether they fall on the walk or down the stairs or assaulted due to lack of proper secure housing, say cameras and secure doors, wouldn't we have a liability anyway? I mean, I can't imagine a landlord wanting to keep a victim who'd been raped in an apartment. I'd kind of like to hear some feedback on that.
The potential liabilities for landlords, yeah.
Yeah, well, I won't go into providing legal advice at this point about the liability of the premises. But what I will say is this, that most landlords understand and see that. And because of that, we're willing to do this. This ordinance was passed for those individuals who were unfortunately in leases with landlords who were not as respectful as it sounds like you would be.
What do you make of the law, Chris? Oh, we just lost him. Well, let's go back to this law, Christy. Where do people go if they're leaving a house and they can't get into a shelter, which we've done shows here, they're oftentimes full. Do shelters have to take people who are being victimized?
No, and it's tough. It's really tough. We are full most of the time. Most shelters are full most of the time. We just don't have adequate resources. And sometimes shelter isn't a great option for somebody, even if shelter's available. Maybe that's not what they're wanting to do for themselves and their families to stay safe.
You know, in many abusive relationships, the leaving part is often the most difficult and sometimes dangerous aspect of all of this. Does this ordinance help ease that in any way, Christy?
I mean, I think that it provides a level of empowerment and self-determination for the person who's seeking to leave and seeking to find a safe space. There's no denying that leaving an abusive relationship is the most dangerous time for somebody who's leaving. We know that the majority of murders that take place in an abusive situation take place after the victim leaves.
What happens in this community if a person who's been victimized is leaving an apartment and they know the physical act of moving out could be problematic? Can they call police and say, listen, I'm moving out at 1 o'clock this afternoon. I think there might be trouble. Would a police officer show up and help with that?
Steve, I've found, yes, that they will. I have had a very good response from KCPD and then in the surrounding areas with our other metropolitan police departments participating in that.
Hey, Christy, how is Kansas City doing these days when it comes to providing safe places for abused people and their families?
I mean, I think that we do the best that we can with our resources. There are some wonderful places providing great resources for families to be safe. You know, we need more of everything. We need more of everything. We would love to be able to provide resources for people who need help with just the moving, like the actual cost of moving to someplace safe, mm-hmm. which is something that we get a lot of requests for that we just don't have. But I think for the most part, there's tons of support and a lot of really good support in Kansas City.
When it comes to open slots of safe living arrangements for people who have been victimized, do we need 30 more slots? Do we need 100 more slots in this community? If you could wave your magic wand, what would you ask for?
Oh, man, that's a tough question. I mean, I'd probably put forward a pretty big ask. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so tough for people who answer the hotline, especially in the summer. When we're full and other shelters are full, we're doing a lot of safety planning for people who are going to stay in their cars with their kids. Mm-hmm. And so it's terrible. So, you know, give me 10 more shelters. Give me more resources for people who need them. Big ask.
Councilwoman, what is it about summertime that brings out the worst? We're talking about all these shootings at the top of our show. Christy just alluded to the fact that summertime's a tough time for victims of abusive relationships. What is it?
Steve, I think it's probably, and I see it in my legal practice every day, the number of kids that are coming into custody because of allegations of juvenile delinquency, the number of domestic violence allegations and charges just go through the roof. I think it's the heat. We all get angry in the heat. I think it's the longer daylight and we're outside more and not in our homes. We see spikes at different times during the year. A lot of times you see a spike over a long weekend. So I think a lot of times it's just kind of circumstances that that lead to that, whether it be just more free time and less productive time that tend to lead to that sort of thing.
Christy, does it go without saying that abused people come from every class, from every gender, from every ethnicity? ethnicity? Maybe we should remind our listeners about that.
Absolutely. Anybody can be in an abusive relationship. We provide services to men, to women. We provide services to trans folks as well. Anybody can be in an abusive relationship.
I failed to give out the National Domestic Violence Hotline number, and I should have done that a couple times here. 1-800-799-7233. Again, 1-800-799-7233. Any other numbers they should be aware of? I think there's a bunch of them out there.
I'm going to definitely provide our hotline number, Please. Which is 816-861-6100.
That's for the Rose Brooks Center?
Yep. And you can also find access to our resources on our website, which is rosebrooks.org.
Okay. That's Christy Boffman, again, Advocacy and Education Manager over at Rose Brooks. We're joined by Councilman Jolie Justice about this important new ordinance that she just got passed before the City Council last week. Thank you both for a good conversation.
Thanks,
Appreciate
Steve.
It.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, Esther George will be here. She heads the Kansas City Federal Reserve. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, we fact-checked claims and ads put out by some of the candidates in Kansas just before Tuesday's primary. Hear who was accurate and who might have been fudging the facts. You can go to kcur.org/up-to-date. And in this digital age, it's kind of surprising how much stuff your kids need for school. It can really add up. Tomorrow, we'll find out what a backpack of school supplies can run you and about local efforts to help parents defray that cost. Well, these days, Esther George is trying to thread the needle, the challenge for the head of the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank and the other members of the Federal Open Market Committee is to set interest rates high enough as to stave off inflation, but not so high as to trigger an economic downturn. Then again, that George is a member of that influential Open Market Committee this year is the result of an unusual staffing quirk. More on that in a few minutes. As CEO of the Kansas City Fed, Esther George leads a workforce of more than 1,600 employees located at the bank's Kansas City office, as well as branch offices in Denver, Oklahoma City, and Omaha. Esther, so good to have you here. Welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be here.
So you're trying to thread this needle on interest rates. Just how difficult a task is that?
Well, it's probably is always a difficult task for members of the FOMC, but I think particularly now, we are now 10 years past what was one of the worst recessions that we've seen, and unwinding some of that stimulus is our real challenge. So as we look at the job market, as we look at the prices of things, the economy is doing well, and our challenge is really how to step away from that without going too far or too slow.
I was going to say, you know, give us a sense of some of the key indicators that someone like yourself considers as you go about trying to decide, you know, whether interest rates should go up or not. How do you evaluate it?
So we start with the objectives really handed to us by Congress. And Congress has asked us to think about the long run, what is sustainable growth for the economy, and to look at two really key metrics. One is looking at employment in this country. And the second is looking at prices to make sure they remain low and stable.
Well, so that makes it sound pretty simple.
It sounds very simple. when you're trying to think about the job market over the last 10 years, though, you know, one of the big debates was what is a natural or a normal rate of unemployment? And trying to understand that when you look across various demographic sectors, when you look at gender and race, and try to understand for the economy as a whole, how low can the unemployment rate go? And we've really been testing the bounds of that, I think, as we look at the current unemployment situation.
I was going to say we're at, 3.9% right now based on the new numbers last week. And does that begin to suggest that when numbers get that low, that that increases inflationary pressures and that maybe is one more reason for you to begin to think about raising rates?
Exactly. So that is historically, the interplay when employment gets very high, meaning the unemployment rate drops, it usually means the economy is robust and you'll start seeing the demand result in higher prices.
Hey, do you buy the idea that the unemployment rate is at 3.9? Because you also hear that there are still lots of people out there who haven't quite landed positions, and maybe the number is higher than what that number suggests.
It could be. I think going into the recession, most economists thought the natural rate of unemployment was somewhere around 5.5%.
Mm-hmm.
So as we test this new bound, a lot of people think perhaps it could be lower today because we haven't seen higher inflation. On the other hand, our economy always has people who are unemployed, and there can be various reasons for that. So the goal is not to reach zero unemployment and think that is a healthy state of affairs.
You know, this is an absolutely monumental responsibility given how these rates affect the American economy. How do you handle a responsibility as sweeping as this one tends to be?
Well, I think you start by a bit of humility about how much we understand about the U.S. economy. But I think for me, importantly, is making sure you are talking to people on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a staff economist. They help us look at the data, but that's all backward looking. What's really important is to get out in the region, and I have a 7-state region, to talk to business people, community leaders, consumer groups, and say, how are you experiencing the economy, and what are your own forecasts for what lies ahead?
You do that yourself.
I do that myself. It's very important. That way we have staff in our branches who help me do that, so I have plenty of help. But I try to get out there because hearing that firsthand really gives you a sense of where are the struggles in the economy, where are things really looking good and maybe overheating.
Kansas City Fed head Esther George is my guest. How much of your job then is about trying to predict the future?
Well, we're required to look at a forecast for the economy because the decisions we make today affect the economy on a lag. So we talk about monetary policy operating with long and variable lags, and that means you have to set a forecast that looks out over the next 18 months to 2 years. And that's imperfect, but that's why, again, it's so important that you're talking to people who are also making decisions about that future. What investments are going to be made? What hiring plans do you have? And that helps us put together the data we've seen for trends, or what might be changing direction that we need to pay attention to.
But still, it sounds like this is ultimately an imperfect science based on what
Absolutely.
You're saying here today.
We should not think that for a $20 trillion economy the size of the U.S., a lot of that is happening across thousands of communities across our country. And it is measured as best it can be, but it is no substitute, I think, for trying to get out and talk to people.
You know, you're known as a hawk when it comes to interest rates, and meaning, I guess, that generally speaking, you think they should be a little higher than what they are. Why is that?
So my objective is not to make sure we have higher interest rates, Steve. The real objective for me is to make sure that we think about the long run for the economy and what is sustainable. And so having higher rates is no goal in and of itself. It's making sure that we're not being too easy for too long and creating distortions in our economy that we will pay for later. And I think history is full of examples where sometimes the committee has gone too slow in making decisions, thinking about the near term, and it's cost us in the long run.
Inflation being a huge, maybe a greater worry to you than even of other people on the board?
So I tend to think not just of inflation, and that always, so we've seen that pop up recently. I also think about imbalances that can occur in your economy. So remember, cheap money is designed to pull forward demand. It's designed to encourage borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do too much of that for too long, it can create imbalances, meaning as rates then begin to rise, some of the deals that look good at zero interest rates don't look so good at 2% interest rates.
You know, what's interesting to me is that the person who has headed the Kansas City Fed has been known traditionally as something of a hawk when it comes to interest rates. Why is that? Is there something about the Kansas City position that has led to that?
Well, I'd like to think it's because we want to be as intellectually honest as we can be, but it could be, too, we're in the Midwest, and I think you tend to find people in our region who try to look at things as honestly as you can. I often think about Harry Truman and the reputation he had for the buck stops here. I think my predecessors and I took seriously the job we had and thinking about what the long-term implications were of our decisions.
Because is the easy answer in your position, Esther, is it to not raise rates? And that's the popular position, right? Being someone who wants to raise them, that displeases a lot of people out there.
Well, I think for sure you're always faced with uncertainty. So no one wants to be wrong. And this is not a business where it is right or wrong. Otherwise, you wouldn't need us. You could dial it up. So yeah, it's a challenging thing to do. But again, it is a job that requires sort of the courage of your convictions. It requires you to think carefully and to be willing to speak to what your concerns are, even if it's not the consensus view.
Esther George, who heads the Kansas City Fed, is my guest. Now, you guys on the Open Market Committee just raised the rate, or you kept the rate unchanged at 1.75 to 2%. If you could wave your magic wand, then what should the rate be?
So that's a big debate right now, is what's the normal interest rate?
Right.
Before the crisis, we thought of the rate that we affect, we call it the federal funds rate, as being 4.25. Today, if you look at the forecasts that each of us individually publish, the consensus is more in the range of 2.75 to 3. Now, whether that turns out to be a long-term issue or that's just within scope of our next 2 years, is something that we continue to debate. So that's why you'll have some people argue maybe we're not that far away from normal yet. I think under any metric, we're not there yet. And so there is still room to continue to move forward.
Typically, when the Fed raises rates, it's done at a quarter of a point at a time. Why is that? I mean, you don't want to rock the boat too much. Is that what that's all about?
I think that's a good way to put it. You are trying to calibrate policy again with imperfect understanding of what its effect is going to be on the economy and at what pace it will affect the economy. So particularly given how long we'd been at zero and how large our balance sheet had affected long-term rates, the decision to go gradually with these incremental moves is one that I support. I think as we back away from some of that accommodative policy, going slow gives us a chance to look and see what effect that's having. So going with these smaller increments has been judged by the committee to be appropriate, and I agree with that.
You know, as a career-long economist, I'm wondering if you can just give us some context in terms of where the country has been. You began our conversation today by talking about where we were a decade ago, and I'm wondering, as you look back at that time, how close to the precipice were we, and how remarkable has it been that we went as long as we did with interest rates effectively at zero? That's so unusual, right?
It's very, very unusual. Unusual, very unconventional things were done to try to stimulate the economy.
And it seemed to, it worked, right?
Well, it has pulled us out of a terrible recession into what I would call a very strong economy.
A terrible recession, the abyss, some people called it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say people that were closer to it than I was, even people that were working on some of the policy solutions, were very concerned. But when you saw how rapidly the unemployment rate went up in this country, how businesses pulled back, that was a very frightening prospect for the U.S. and one that arguably required the central bank and the federal government to take a strong response. Obviously, 10 years later, people are looking back to say, was it right or wrong? And I suspect for decades to come, people will be asking that question.
But if we're in this place today, 10 years later, you've described the economy now as very robust and strong. In just a 10-year period, considering where we were, that strikes me as a trade-off that most Americans might say, okay, I'll take that.
I have no complaints with where we are today in terms of the economy. What I think we have to watch going forward, though, we have not returned the policies that were put in place back to something more normal. That's true of the fiscal debt that was incurred. It's true of monetary policy. Once we get back to something that I think we can all say is normal, then I'll be happy to join with others in saying, job well done. I think until we get through that, though, I want to be a little careful to say there was no cost to that policy. But clearly comparing the U.S. performance to the rest of the world, I think we're very pleased with where we are today.
How did you even wind up on the Open Market Committee? Because I read an article that sort of suggested that it was the result of a quirk in Fed staffing around the country, including San Francisco and New York.
Yeah, so not so much a quirk, but it's actually a design of the committee. So okay. There are 12 Fed presidents. They rotate, but for the New York Fed, who always has a vote, the other 11 rotate. And so the Kansas City Fed, the San Francisco Fed, and Minneapolis are in a rotation. This is the year that the San Francisco Fed is a voting member. And I serve as the alternate. And because there has been a change in the leadership of the San Francisco Fed, John Williams went to the New York Fed, that position is currently open. And in that situation, the vote goes to the alternate member, which is me this year.
Does that mean you'll be on the Open Market Committee for 2 years then?
I'll be on. I voted at this most recent meeting last week. I'll be there until they appoint someone through the end of the year. If they don't, I'll continue to vote. And then 2019, I will resume voting what would be my normal rotation.
Is this a task that you welcome, being on the Open Market Committee, and again, the power that goes with that?
Well, it's a privilege to serve on this committee, let me say first of all.
Sure.
And I take very seriously that responsibility. So you do the same amount of work, whether you vote or not at these meetings. In other words, your staff gets you ready, you think about, and you get to participate in those discussions, whether you vote or not. So in that sense, I'm always prepared, and that preparation will result in a vote now that I'm serving in the San Francisco alternate role.
As a member of the Open Market Committee, do you get lobbied? I mean, do you have U.S. senators who call you up and say, Esther, I don't want you to raise that rate this time, or head of Chase Manhattan Bank calling you up saying, don't do it, Esther, you know, or does that happen?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say it happens directly, but clearly, when you engage with the public to understand how the economy's doing, people also and I do ask, how's the current interest rate environment affecting you? Because you want to know, how easy is credit? How tight is credit? How do people see the implications for their business? So by virtue of asking about the economy, you're going to get the other part of that as well.
You know, at a symposium last month in Kansas City, you said this. I'm going back to the overall state of the economy now. I'm going to quote you. You said, the U.S. economy is in excellent shape, operating with tight labor markets and low and stable inflation. I'm wondering, how long has it been since the economy was in this good a shape?
Well, we thought it was in that good a shape going back to 2006 and 7, only to learn there was a bubble behind that called the housing crisis, which derailed
right.
it. Today, there are no obvious signs of something that looks like it's about to derail this economy. And so we are in a good place in terms of seeing people go back to work, seeing their wages go up, and at the same time, watching inflation carefully, because it is rising. For most of that decade that we just talked about, inflation stayed below 2%, which is a marker that the FOMC looks at mm-hmm. for what would be low and stable. It's beginning to bump up above that level. So we'll keep an eye on that to make sure that it doesn't get out of hand.
How beneficial to the economy was the recent decision, the fairly recent decision, to cut taxes by the Trump administration and by Congress?
So we watch how other economic policy is made. And when the tax cuts came about, economists spend a lot of time trying to estimate what will it mean in the near term, what does it mean over the next few years. I think what we're beginning to see is it will serve as stimulus to our economy. And we see that in consumer spending. We see it in business investment.
But do we need stimulus to an economy that's already coming back?
Yeah, so that will be one of the challenges for the Federal Reserve, is to be able to take into account its own very accommodative monetary policy and then having fiscal stimulus come in on top of it. And the question that I think is on the table is, does that change how quickly we move interest rates? Can we continue to move in this slow and gradual fashion? And I think that's something we continue to watch.
In that recent talk you gave, you said the cuts came during a business cycle expansion, and you noted that they carry the risk of pushing the economy beyond its productive capacity. What does that mean, pushing the economy beyond its productive capacity? Because you guys at the Fed always use this language that I always struggle to understand, Esther.
Yeah. Good question, yeah. Steve. So the issue for us is what is, I mentioned a sustainable growth rate for the U.S. economy in the long run. And based on our demographics, based on how fast or how slow the workforce is growing, what productivity looks like in the U.S., most economists will judge that the economy is capable of growing at about 1.75%, or let's say 2% over the long run. If you look at the most recent GDP numbers,
right,
they were considerably higher than that, closer to 4%. So that suggests the economy is growing beyond its capacity over the long run. Is that bad? Not necessarily, but it does make you watch to see what's boosting that. And will we be able to keep up? The way our demographics are growing more slowly and productivity is slow, it suggests we can't grow at that rate indefinitely without some other changes.
You know, unemployment, as you've mentioned, is now just below 4%. Again, that's considered full employment, but there's always a downside. And in this case, the question is, how much trouble are employers out there having, you know, finding workers to fill all the jobs that are there? What are you seeing on that front?
I'm increasingly hearing that employers are having a tougher and tougher time finding people. They're beginning to try to do more things themselves around training, but they're having a hard time. We do a survey asking manufacturers and other businesses, what's your number one concern? Even getting applicants is now becoming a concern. That tells you we are in a very, very tight labor market. And I suspect one of two things happen after that. Some businesses are saying, we're narrowing our hours. In some cases, we can't expand because we can't find the workers. Or traditionally, what we expect to see is wages begin to move higher as employers begin to bid up trying to get employees away from others.
So. I was going to say, one thing that's amazed me that I don't understand is if employment is so low, why haven't wages risen faster? That seems counterintuitive to me, and I haven't understood why that's not been more direct causation there.
Yeah, well, you join many economists who are still puzzling over this a bit, too.
Yeah.
I think some of the answers that resonate with me is when you look, for example, at our demographics, so baby boomers are beginning to retire. When you bring in newer employees to those jobs, wages are lower than they would have been for some of those higher paid employees. We also see larger firms today, and they have for some time had more ability to provide other kinds of benefits to employees. People want more flexibility. They may be looking for what I call non-traditional ways of compensating them. That could also be contributing to these lower wages. Again, as we see, too, many lower-skilled jobs compared to past recoveries, that has kept general wages down, I think. But we are beginning to see those pick up. So if you look at the last numbers, wages are staying ahead of inflation in aggregate. That's not true of every job.
Right.
So we should begin to see more wage pressure as we go forward, I think.
Esther George is my guest. She heads the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. If you want to join our conversation, you can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Al, good morning.
Good morning. Cool show, and thank God for the Fed. That's a whole other thing.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Al.
But my question is, how much of this robust economy is actually momentum from previous administrations, and how does the next, let's say, 2 or 3 years look from their point of view? Is this robust economy as a result, or is it in reality what's happening right now?
Yeah, thank you, Al. Esther?
So I agree. The economy is looking good. And if you look at the forecasts that the individual participants on the Federal Open Market Committee have put out there, you will see that our forecast consistently show the economy growing over the next couple of years. That is good news. We've taken into account what's happening at the federal level. What we don't always measure very well, though, is what are some of the downside or upside risks? What could go wrong in the economy? What uncertainty exists? So I'll give you an example. we hear a lot of discussion today about trade.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when you look down to say what actually has been put in place, it's hard to find measurable results. But we do know that uncertainty could cause businesses to say, you know, I might just wait and see. And that wait and see at some point could feed through to the economy. So I think the bottom line is things look good over the next few years. There are always risks to that outlook, and we're going to be watching those very carefully.
If I understood Elle's question right, he may have been asking, does President Obama deserve credit for where the economy stands today?
So I would say any economy reflects the policies that the administration, Congress, and others put into place. It's certainly not just the Federal Reserve that influences that, but it is something that we react to. So yes, policies that have been put in place over the previous administration have affected the economy we see today.
I've got like 30 seconds left. This notion of a trade war with China and other nations, how concerned should we be about the impact that could have here in the heartland where agriculture obviously is so important?
So I think a lot of people are concerned, and it's something I'm watching carefully. We live in a global economy today, mm-hmm. increasingly, and agriculture, as you mentioned, Steve, is key to that. And I'm hearing a lot from those that depend on export markets for their goods, soybeans, for example. These are very, very important issues. And I'm going to be keeping tabs as I listen to both the ag sector, manufacturing, and others on what implications this has.
The Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City will be sponsoring a free digital inclusion seminar, Bridging the Digital Divide, an Economic Imperative for the 21st Century. It'll be at 12:30 this Wednesday at the bank's central office. You can visit kansascityfed.org for more information. Esther George, thanks for coming in today. I really appreciate the good conversation.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
Tomorrow on the show, state fairs are known for their food, funnel cake, corn dogs, but what about the gourmet stuff? We'll talk about it tomorrow in the Missouri Grown Bistro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.